Today is the 28th of November 2017. I'm interviewing Did Erickson of Miani on his family. Did, would you like to tell us something about your family?
Well, as far as I can go back, my grandfather on Dad's side and mother came from Denmark, I think around about 1890. And they settled up in Guthrie Smith's of Tutera. He was a cowman gardener and she was the cook until the family started to turn up, and then they shifted down here. And the reason they shifted to here, as I understood, there was a lot of Scandies, Pallisons and Ericssons. Niels Peter was my grandfather's brother. So they were settled in this district, dairy farming and pigs and that sort of thing. So that's the reason they came. I understand there was some talk of them leaving Europe because of the political situation over there in the Crimean War and all. And they were thinking of going to San Francisco. Because Niels Peter came to Hawke's Bay or to New Zealand, they came here to be with him. He was 10 years junior to my grandfather. Grandfather was a bit older than him. Niels Peter was a carrier, cannon, had a tannery, and he was quite a go-getting sort of a guy.
Was this locally?
Yeah, no, here, like, he was a carrier, had a tannery, wool wash, I think, and he was on the county council, and Erickson Road is not after my side of the family, it's after Niels Peter. Anyway, so then the family turned up. There was Eric, the oldest, then Kate, then Ivy, then Fred from Coroquipo, the Aunty Daisy and Alma, and then Dad. There was seven in the family. Dad was born in 1906, and he said he was an accident because his mother was 40 and his father was 52 when he was born.
So they would have gone to school where?
Miani.
They lived here in Miani, went to school in Miani.
Yeah, yes. Miani school. Yeah, then the eldest son, Eric, he went off to the First World War and he never come back. He got killed in 1918. He was 24. And when the war finished, Dad was 11 or 12, so he was only a young fella, you know. They sold the farm after Grandfather died in 1926. Well, no, before that, they sold the farm and shipped it into Napier South. I'm not sure where, but into Napier South. And the people that bought the farm couldn't handle the depression, and they walked off. So Grandfather died in 1926, and Dad was 20, and Grandmother was whatever. So she was on her own, he was on his own, and she said to him, I think, well, Jack, we've got to go back. Got
to go back to the farm.
So they shifted back to the farm and they carried on.
So whereabouts in Miani was the farm?
Here.
Oh, this one. So you've had it all that time, the family?
Yeah, they sold the farm and were going to retire. And they settled Fred at Coroquipo, so he was upset. And the girls all got a house, and they got bugger all, actually. He was working down south. He was on a harvesting contract with steam engines and Fairley and around Timaru and that sort of thing.
Miani at that time wasn't very far from the inland sea that came right through Te Awa down to...
Oh no, from what you read of it, the only reason Miani was there was the track taking you through to Puketap and eventually over the hills to Taupo.
Yes.
There was no way to get from Taradale to Napier. You had to come round through Awatoto. It was all flooded. So anyway, then next thing I suppose was the Depression and then the Second World War. And then during the Second World War, I think, things were much improved financially. Mm. There was a good demand for everything you were making, producing milk, butter, whatever. Import restrictions, couldn't buy any bloody thing because Dad said, plenty of money in the bank because he couldn't spend it. In 1956, Dad built the house up there and he paid cash. In 52, he bought a new car, Plymouth. He tossed old Billy Richmond for 65 acres down the end of King's Road and won. And he paid cash. So we must have been doing pretty good money in those years.
So when they started milking cows, they wouldn't have been town milk, would they? They would have been for the...
No, I'm only going from what he told me. Yeah, he supplied cream to Blue Moon. Well, actually, he didn't know it at the time, but he was supplying Willie Hazelwood. He owned Blue Moon at one time. But then the McLean brothers, Napier, they came and picked the milk up, the three brothers, and they had deliveries. Dad didn't go to town on it, I don't know. His father did. He took the horse and dray to town and delivered the milk, but I don't think he did. He got Tubby McLean, and they come and picked the milk up, and then the raw milk producers came on the scene, William Street, bottling plant. Then Jack Dumble turned up, and he picked the milk up. Wyhick was started. That was a cheese factory.
So did you supply Wyhick cheese factory?
No, it never got supplied direct from anybody. It was the leftover milk from the days of what they didn't need, or anything that was substandard, any graded milk, that went up there to make casein and
stuff
cheese.
That might have been coloured by beetroot from
whatever.
Franksteiners.
Yeah. Frank was a bugger.
Eventually you became part of the milk producers.
That's right.
So you're a pioneer family there too.
Yeah, I don't think we thought of ourselves as such, but he was pretty independent, very independent man. Well, the family really, and he sort of drummed into us, like he hated rules and regulations. You know, if you have a shop owner, whose affair is it, I can remember him saying it now, whose affair is it, anybody but your own, when you open and shut your doors? It's up to you. If you want to open the doors at 2 in the bloody morning, why can't you?
It's your time.
Yeah, and he, you know, hated any rules at all, and, you know, like, he'd say to you, we're not them, we're us, and, like, holidays, well, that was for other people, it didn't include us. He had a bit of a wry sense of humour. I'd say to him, as a teenager, I might go to town after lunch on Friday, but the shops weren't open at the weekend.
That's right.
So I'd get myself some clothes or something, and he'd say, you had a day off a couple of years ago, didn't you?
But they lived to work, and holidays weren't part of it.
Oh, no, no. Oh, he was adamant on that sort of thing. You know, I remember him saying, it was easy to get on. Not hard, he said, not hard. He said, you don't have to have a flash education. All you need to do is work 8 hours, and you work another 8 hours. You still got 8 hours to bugger around. go to sleep.
Different time.
Not that I mind it, I didn't mind it. It's like one instance I remember, old Ian Bonhardt, he used to keep the pea vine silent, bird's eye. We had two pips up Sandy, and old Von had come and see Dad about taking all the silage on Christmas Day, I think it was. And we got up there after milking, crikey dick, there was pea vine everywhere. The pits were full, and Dad was on the front end loader, and I was on the pitchfork, and we were tidying this bloody mess up, and we had a cup of tea about, I don't know, had a break, and a car went past on Sandy Road. And he looked up and he said, because he knew all the cars, who was that one? He said, I said, I don't know. Useless buggers here driving around wasting time and petrol. We're lucky we've got this pea vine to stack. It was Christmas Day. We milked the cows on the pea vine silage, or used to get a couple of loads. We had our own truck, we used to go and get it, Dodge truck. And I was 14, and Dad let me go at night time and get the pea vine. But we used to feed it out fresh, you know, straight off the truck. Pea hay, barn was full of that, so we milking our cows on what came out of the factory, really. Yeah, the pea vine was very good, though. It was damn good feed.
Yes, you never got into feeding peaches and beetroot.
Not like Frank, no. He used to get the brewer's grain from the...
As you said, you started growing ground crops.
Yeah, we started growing when I just started high school. I think it was about then, 1956 or 7. We grew our first 5 acres of tomatoes, and that gradually increased, and then other crops, beans and sweet corn, and we leased land and grew more crops for the factory until it got to the stage where we really couldn't do it. We were going 7 days a week. You can't go 24 hours a day, but we did our damn best. And in 1970, Dad was getting on a bit, and I'd leased, to 1967, I'd leased 65 acres over the river, a catchment board. And then Percy Smith, he came and seen me, Derek Smith, at least 130 acres at Powdwell's Road. And he'd got cancer, and he was a year or two younger than me. Percy came to me over at the old house and asked me if I'd take over the lease of 130 acres. And so that gave me 200 odd acres of lease ground that I was working on my own account, plus at home. So, you know, I had one Nuffield tractor. And I bought another one after that. I was sort of getting up before I went to bed pretty near.
I like that term. Pressure's on, especially at planting time, because those days a lot of the crops were picked into boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Tomatoes.
60 pounds they were, yeah. We all had to, everybody else went 4 high, but we had to go 5 high, which is up here.
Yes.
So then, I remember he laughingly leased this block over the river. Peter Bestie had it leased, and anyway, I got this lease, put the tender in, and got it, and in the first year, I made about $14,000 or $15,000 profit, but I didn't know it, but Dad had me down as a tax dodge. So on my profit. I was paying him 19 and bloody sixpence in the pound tax. And he laughed about it.
So he did all that work for six bloody pence in the dollar.
Him and old Roddy Wims had had me down with an income, but I never got.
Yes, so then you went into asparagus during that period as well.
Oh, no, before that. Would have been in the late 50s, 1958, 59. We bought the Tattersalls, Dick Tattersalls, 36 acres on the other side of the river, and we put 18 acres, one block of it, in asparagus in 1958. And we more or less had various blocks in asparagus continuous up until... Oh, I don't really remember when we finished. And then I planted again in latter years. Well, we would have been still growing in the 70s and mid-70s.
Because some of that land you would have planted into grapes, wouldn't you?
Yes, down the end of King's Road I put it into grapes. I one block over there, we put it in grapes.
So why did you change to grapes? It looked a much better proposition to all the other crops.
Dad was in hospital and... I'd been thinking about it. I don't know how it came about. I'd been thinking about putting a block and put some grapes on. And I went to see him in the hospital up on the hill. And he'd been thinking the same thing. And he said to me, why don't you go and talk with Tom MacDonald? That's right, I was going to put in apples, Granny Smith's and that, at the end of King's Road on the block of Richmond spot. So I went and saw Tom. Not that I really knew him at that stage, but then I went and saw him and I told him. He called up Papakura, and he said, I'll come and have a look at the block. So I went with him down the end of King's Road, and he dug a little hole in the ground, and he looked at it, and said, oh yeah, it'll grow grapes. And I've still got that little contract somewhere. So I signed up to grow 60 acres over 5 years, 12 acres a year, and I financed that through the maize I was growing. The only trouble was I wasn't getting enough money for the maize and spending too much on the grapes. So the bank came to the party and helped me on that, which was a bit worried. But anyway, so every winter I'd be planting grapes, yeah. 5 years. Well, I got to the end of that, and then I decided, oh, well, I'll put another 20 acres in. So I planted another 20 acres down the end of King's Road. So that gave me 80 acres of grapes. And then 1974, I lost my grapes. Easter rain come, and by the time it cleared on the Monday, Tuesday, they're rotten. And I just started picking. I only had about 12 acres that year, but oh boy, I was close to the wind financially. Yes. I lost a lot.
Were you machine picking then?
No, hand picking. It was 74. Yes. That's how I remember it. Yes. So I was out at the grain dryer. We had a grain dryer on the Maha Road. Me and Gordon all used to camp up there. So I was at the grain dryer and I had a buggered auger. The auger was stuck when this guy turned up. I didn't know him. And he said to me, are you Dick Erickson? I said, yeah. He said, I'm Dick Blackburn. I said, are you? He said, I'm the agent for Chisholm Rider Grape Harvesters. I said, yeah. Are you interested? I said, I'm more interested in getting this bloody auger going than I am a grape harvester. But I got thinking about it on the way home. So instead of coming straight home, I went round past Mark Reed. And I said to Mark, the coral keeper, I said to Mark, what do you think about what buy a grape harvester? Would you come and give me a hand? Not financially, come and give me a hand. Yeah, he said, I'll do that. So I said, I'm going to go and see Eric Gray. He's a good bugger. He might give me a hand. I went and saw Eric, yep. Machine turned up. Roddy Wims had jacked up the money. God knows how. And I said, I don't want to put any land up as collateral. I said, it's got to stand on its own, which he did. And the machine turned up in November, out in the paddock out the front there. And on a Sunday, nothing else to do, I'd get out there, put a couple of Waratah standards in and drive over the top, trying to get the hang of this. I didn't even have a clue how the damn thing worked. It cost me $40,000. That was the start of the machine harvesting. And first of all, it was a bit of a white elephant because none of the vineyards were really suitable. They were too low, and headlands were too small. Quite a lot of, you know, the old established vineyards had to be modified. The new ones are all right because the plantings were going ahead pretty quick. But it took a while. Before, I think I did about three seasons with one harvester, and then it got just silly. You know, I was sleeping on the side of the damn road and, and between trucks, and yeah. So then I got the second harvester, and Eric drove that, Eric Gray. And Campbell Agnew drove one for me, Tim Plowman drove them, Graham Watson drove them.
So, how many did you have at your peak?
Four. But they weren't continuously When the Mulasurgo was in its heyday, they were used continuously, but they changed to the other varieties, and they were more of a convenience. They've been written down in the books now, and so I could park one out on the Taupo Road and just leave it there. And instead of taking the machine out there, I'd go and do 10 acres and then leave it out there. Yeah. One at Gimlet Road, one at Corokipo, one out for Tokitok. Because we used to go from Tokitok out to the Taupo Road, and I mean, it's
half a day driving.
Oh, God, yes. Hell, yes. Yeah. Made a lot of the machinery ourselves. Did a lot of the experimenting for the company in America, because they got 6 months. Their winter time was our harvest time.
Yes,
so anything that they wanted to have a look at for the next machine, they'd send it out to us, and we'd put it in and try it out in place harvesting and the different shaped catcher trays, different belts and that sort of stuff. Old Chuck Burton, he used to come out every year from America and bring his new ideas out with him.
Well, it was quite a little industry for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it was.
Because you had all these other grape growers who were driving your gear.
Oh, yeah. The blokes that were good operators usually had good rhythm, synchronised. Some people were hopeless. But others, you know, nice and smooth.
So how long did your machine harvest?
I sold out to Graham Watson, and I had other things to do anyway. I bought a farm down in Central Hawke's Bay, so I decided I had enough of harvesting grapes. So it's Graham Watson and Stephen Harper and George Gunn. They tried and put Harvest Hawke's Bay together. Yeah, that's where that comes from.
Is that still going?
Yeah. Oh, they've had a bit of a tough time too, as I understand it was last year. It's all changed. And Sam and Campbell, and they don't want to do it anymore either.
And so at that stage, you had grapes still of your own.
Oh, yeah.
So you had to pay someone to come and harvest those for
you. Oh, I kept two of the old ones. I still got a bit here and a bit there, just for friends and that.
And so you went into a major planting of apples, didn't you?
I knew that was my son-in-law, well, ex-son-in-law now, but when Brendan Downey came on the scene, it was his trade, and we had this land. So the suggestion was go into apples, which seemed the right thing to do at the time. And I think it was, but it wasn't. We're spending too much producing a bushel of apples and not getting enough for them. So then along come Mr. Apple, and he made an offer which was miles more than we could make out of it. Miles and miles more. And so that's just tipped over 5 years now. And I've just had a revaluation, and it's substantially increased. And so, I don't know, I think I'll just let it go, leave it as it is.
How much land do you still own?
I'm not sure. Well, about 120 or 150 or something.
It's enough to keep you out of mischief.
Yeah. Yeah, I sold the end of King's Road, 65 acres. I sold over the river. I sold 36 acres. I sold the high school farm, 130 acres. I sold the grain dryer. That was all to do with raising the money. Well, then my wife decided she'd had enough. Can't really blame her. So I had to square her up. So that cost me another couple of bloody million. And yeah, it's only bloody money.
So when you met your wife, where did you meet her? Was she a local person?
No, she was from Waipa. I went shepherding. I was only a young fella, 20. And I worked down in Central Hawke's Bay shepherding for a little while. Then I went deer culling for a little while down south, sort of my OE, I suppose, but I didn't go overseas. And I met Jenny down in Waipa, and we eventually got married and had 5 kids.
So your children, are they all still around here?
They were away, but they've all come back to Miani. Kate's in Miani, Elsa's in Taradale, Sarah's here, Amanda's in Taradale.
Yeah. Mainly girls?
Yeah, 4 girls, 1 boy.
Is your son still local?
Yeah. Well, he's separated too now, but anyway, he's living with his mother, Jenny, but he's working for Willie Agnew, flat out. So, yeah, I don't know, just 5 kids and 3 of them are separated. Didn't know anyone when I grew up. I didn't know anyone that was separated.
I didn't either. All we knew was work.
Well, that was the only reason we were put here, according to what my father told me. And even now, I get guilty if I should be doing something. And I've got to say to myself, no, you don't have to. You can read a book. You don't have to go and do it. There's no need to now. You don't need to.
Yes, I used to feel guilty if I stopped.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, no one ever said how we're taught to, you know, head down, bum up, work. But no one ever said what you did when you stopped working. How do you retire? I don't know. Dad never really retired. He just slowed down. I'd get the farm all ready and he'd go and cultivate beans, and if he got sick of it, he'd come home and that. And if he didn't want to go, it was not nice weather, he didn't bother going. That was a nice way of...
Yeah, slowing down. So, you know, over the time, you've certainly seen some changes. We went from hand-planted to machine-harvested.
I don't know whether tomato sauce was enormously expensive or how they could make hand-picked tomatoes into tomato sauce and make a profit, I really don't know. We seem to, $25 a tonne, or $36, was £18, and then in the channel change it went to $36
a tonne. And you know, when you think back to the old Nuffield you used to drive, to what the tractors are like now.
Yeah, God, yes. Oh, they're a beautiful piece of machinery, the new ones, and they've even evolved since I got out. I mean, the last ones were 7800 John Deere's, so it was sort of state of the art. But they've evolved from there, you don't even steer the damn thing.
When you see the paddocks that they sow down just in grass after the crops, all the lines are absolutely perfectly straight.
They are, yeah. I think when I look back, and I said that to Ken Apatow before he passed away, we've been lucky. We've been very lucky. We've had the best of times. I believe we have. We had good relationship with old Jim Waddy and the factory, and Tom McDonald and that winery. It was a one-on-one basis, man-to-man, and rich agreements, and that. It's all changed now. It's all run by accountants, and, you know, if they get it for nothing, they will. No allegiance.
No, none at all. The other thing is how Hawke's Bay has changed with the drainage.
Oh, yes. Before they put the pumps in down at Awatodo, this area here, if it got wet in the wintertime, it would take all summer for it to dry out. It was only gravity, and it wasn't very good at that. But once they put the pumps in and then the tile drainage, what was the tile?
Don Riak
came out. We tile drained down the end of King's Road, and then we got the hang of that, and then tile drained the house block, and tile drained over here. And made an enormous difference.
Oh, yeah. You know, all the land was listed as high water table. Of course, once we controlled the water table, then we had to turn around and irrigate it, didn't we?
You're really, before that, you're virtually a fair weather farmer, because once the rain comes, once you got wet, hails, fairies, and here, it was just diabolical to get a damn duck stuck around here when it was wet. You know, the old house there, I think I told you the story about 1897. The big flood came and grandmother put fresh water on the kitchen table and got the kids up into the roof of the old house. Grandfather was off trying to help sandbagging or something. He never came back. They found him. They thought he drowned, but he hadn't. He got on an island somewhere. The story we were told is that when the flood receded, the water was washed off the kitchen table, the bowl. That's how deep the water was, you see. 1954, Dad decided to refurbish the old house, and he put this new stuff called Gibraltar board in. Well, when they took the wallpaper down, then the scrum, there was the silt on the walls from the 97 flood. So it was a true story. Went right through the house.
Incredible.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little written about the history of how wet Hawke's Bay was once.
Well, the rivers were just, you know, and then there was the rivers board. But the Taradale, they'd sandbag, they'd put a stop bank up, which made all the water go to Parkawai, and then Parkawai put a sandbank up, a private one, and then it would push it all over that way. So it was all fragmented. It wasn't properly done until after the earthquake.
The Tutukuri used to come from Taradale. Where did it cut through to Napier?
It went down through Frank Steiner's, through Miami.
Through Riverbend Road?
No, it went down to George's Drive and then out to the Fine Pond. Yes. That was before the quake. It couldn't make it round what they call Powdrill's Bend. Up here, and that's when it broke through the stop banks. And apparently, one of the 38, I think, the whole river flowed past our back door, broke the banks of it behind Hales, Powdrill's Corner, and came through and it ran through out to sea through Fred Jessop, through Bill King's. Well, then the 31 earthquake, and the whole place tipped over. All the levels changed and angles changed. So then they had to do something, and so they diverted it and put it into there. Dad had he had two teams, I think. Huey Johnson, did you remember? Yeah, Huey Johnson was one driver, the dad from Clive, and Charlie Sage was another one, and he had the stop bank teams and the shovels. Jack Whitfield was on the go, he had a team, and Joe Green was one of the young fellas on a shovel. I've got some photographs somewhere of them doing the stop banks here with the horses. Dad said it was quite good because he made a few bob, you know. But 1931, it was the middle of the Depression.
And today you've leased all your orchards to Big Apple. And do you have any grapes left?
No. They carried on 1 year with what I had left. And Pinot Noir down the end of King's Road and Pinot Gris in the house block. Chardonnay behind the cabos. And they carried on for 1 year or 1 or 2 years until they got trees available, I think. And then they just converted it all, took the whole things and established new apples.
So you've been living on your own for how long now?
I don't sort of think of it as being on my own so much. Got the kids all around me. Still see Jenny occasionally. We still, well, about 14 years now.
But even when you were working, you were living on your own, weren't you?
Yeah, that's what I want. If I've got any regrets, I think that's one. I wished I'd have spent more time. Like my oldest kids, Amanda and Sarah, really didn't know me. They said, we were never there, you know, I was never there. But that wasn't quite true. But the girls went to Iona and Sam went to Lindisfarne. But that was Mum's idea, not so much mine. I quite like the kids coming home from school, but anyway. Anyway, 1974, 75, wet season, I had a Falcon station wagon, V8, 73 model, and that's all I had. And the bloody thing was a terrible mess by the time I'd finished grape harvesting. It was a stinking mess. God, makes Frank Steiner's truck feel like a bloody limousine. Anyway, so we had to get the girls back to school, and so they put all that in the car. Must have been May holidays, I suppose. And we'd just finished harvesting. May holidays, yeah. Anyway, come on, we'll get there quick. I said I didn't want to be there when the Volvos and the BMWs started turning up. So off we went, and I got the car and opened the tail station wagon, got the bags out, kiss, kiss, kiss. See you later. I hopped back in the car, and a bloody car wouldn't start. And it was, oh, crikey. And no jumper leads. So then the Volvos and the bloody BMWs started turning up, and all of a sudden I tried again, and BOOM! Jesus, sounded like the mongrel mob just turned up.
So now you're sitting here in your lovely home, retired. Are these granddaughters?
Yeah, well, Sarah was head prefect at Iona when she was there. That's Ariana's mother. And Ariana was head prefect at Abigail's High School. Oh. So I pity her future daughter, she ought to be head prefect. Well, I really haven't, and I should, for the memory. I've emphasised the Erickson side of the family, but I haven't mentioned my mum. She very much deserves to be mentioned, because without her, she was quite a bit junior to my dad. She was 14 years younger than Dad. Dad was married twice. His first wife, Jean, was my mum's sister, and she passed away when she was 20. After the birth of my elder sister, Jean. Right. And so Jean, my sister, the elder one, well, half-sister, I suppose, half-cousin, she was raised by a nanny, Joyce Innes. And then Dad married my mum in 1941 or 2 or something. But Mum was born in 1920, so she was 14 years junior to Dad. So she was the live wire. Dad was very conservative. Mum was more jovial and outward-going. The Ferry family came from Nelson and moved up here in 1917, and they lived over the back fence. That was in Ferry's.
Well, that was Ted.
Ted Ferry's mum's brother, Ted Casson, and mum and cousins. Mum had a pretty hard time, because when she was 15, her mother died. She was left. Dad married Jean, her elder sister. So grandfather, George, and mum at 15 became the household mother. That was in 1935, and then 1937, Jean died. And so that was another knock. So Mum was sort of mother to everybody as a teenage girl. Imagine. And she had to raise Uncle Nim. He was quite a bit junior to her. And grandfather really never, George, he never really got over his wife dying. I don't know what she died of. But yeah, Mum was the, kept us on the straight and narrow, more so than Dad, I think. Yeah. They came from Nelson. It was 1870, I think, they settled in Nelson. So there was only about, I can't remember, I've got it somewhere. There's only half a dozen families, so they're all related. They all married each other. And there were the Hodgkinsons and the Jessops and the Newman brothers and Ferries and that. And they're all related with the brother's name, the Bakers that bought Watties. They were Bakers, the two brothers. Yeah. Well, they're cousins of some sort too. They're from down there. Yeah. Then in the Ferry side, or Ferry Aviation, Fred Ferry. And that was, oh, I don't know, they built ferry battles in that First World War. Grandfather George's brother He was a First World War fighter pilot. He flew the ferries over there in France.
They flew a ferry swordfish.
Yeah. They went off the aircraft carrier. Yeah.
And your mother, what age was she?
Mum died in 1998. She would have been 78. Dad died in 1980. He was 74. So I've got a couple of years to go to pass Mum, and I've just passed Dad.
So yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to say about your mother?
No, not really. She was an outward-going lady. She was president of the ladies' golf home in Napier. She was the mother of the year elected. I don't know how that happened. She was interviewed by the radio station, and, you know, she sort of had to pull herself up by her own bootstraps. Mm. But in saying that, she was very... Mrs. Hale, John Hale's mother, she was just next door, and she was there to help, and the neighbours. Like, you knew everybody. I don't think I knew people. No one moved in the district. No one sort of moved out. They just were always there. That's where the Dallagers lived. That's where the Cokers lived. Yes. That's where the Griffiths lived. Yeah. They were always been there, you know. Ferries, they've always been there. Now there's only me and Cass left.
The Englishes, too.
Oh, Ted English, yeah.
He was very much part of the rodeo grounds, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Oh, he loved his horses. I used to go down there, and he had a hand-driven shearing machine, and he used to do the high tide mark on his horse, and I'd turn the handle for him, and he'd go along there and click them.
Yes, so thank you very much, Dib, for that.